Welcome to Recipe for Peace Now. I'm your host, Sue Beller, and this is the show where we find practical, real-life solutions to difficulties bringing people together for a common goal, a common good. We will discuss listener emails, answer common questions, and at the end of the show, we will have a delicious, well, we'll have two delicious potluck recipes made for sharing with your new community of, well, if not exactly friends, at least willing participants. If you would like to send in a question or a favorite recipe, please email us at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com. Also, you can visit our website at www.recipeforpeacenow.com. If you would like to hear prior shows, the last five, the most recent ones, are archived on our website, recipeforpeacenow.com. All of the shows, including the last five, are archived at the radio station at blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. Thanks. Now let's get started. You know, this time we're going to be talking about mentoring. And as we do quite a few times, we're going to first define what we mean by a mentor. So what's the definition of mentor? What do we mean when we say that someone is our mentor or that someone has asked us to be their mentor, which happens quite a bit, I imagine. So what do we mean by that? And I see we have lots of people. Thank you very much for all of you being here. And we're getting quite a bit of agreement on about what a mentor is. I see a lot of people saying that a mentor is an advisor. Very good, yeah. Somebody who advises you what to do when you're not certain. Counselor is being used, which is kind of an advisor, right? A counselor is someone who advises you and tells you their opinion on what you should do. Leader is being used as a term. Yes, mentors are usually leaders in their field. Or leaders of your group, because you respect them, you look up to them, and you want to follow them, so they become your mentor. Mm-hmm. Now, here's an interesting phrase that several people are using. They're saying that, and thank you for all of your participation, that a mentor is your moral compass, somebody who keeps you, well, honest, someone who keeps you doing the moral and ethical thing. Even when it might not be technically to your economic or professional advantage, but it's the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. Your moral compass. What an interesting thought. Mm-hmm. And quite a few people are saying that their mentor is also their spiritual leader. And I think maybe spiritual leader and moral compass are the same kind of an idea. There's somebody who is a very ethical person, a very moral person, and therefore they're a good mentor because they wouldn't give you advice that is less than, well, less than prudent, less than ethical, that might be kind of, well, not so legal. Yeah, they wouldn't do a thing like that, right? Right. A lot of people are saying that your mentor is a trusted individual. A trusted individual and a respected individual, someone who you respect the opinions of and would like to follow. And you think, well, if they said so, maybe I should think about it, maybe I should do it, because they have a lot of experience and they are people of good moral character and they're leaders and advisors and I trust them and respect them. Mm-hmm. You know, this is interesting. I don't usually think of this as a mentor, but I don't know why not. I mean, and I always say, I always learn something on these shows, and I hope you do too, that quite a few people are mentioning mentors who I would call professional mentors, like psychiatrists and guidance counselors and coaches. Yeah, people who are professional mentors, people who are, well, they might take a personal interest in you, but they are also paid to do so. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing wrong with that. That certainly is an excellent mentor, as someone that you respect the opinion of and that you look up to and trust. Good point. Just never thought of a professional really as a mentor. Usually think of them as volunteers. But that's a very good point, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, here's another good point, and thank you for all of your participation. I love having you. quite a few people are mentioning as mentors people I wouldn't, that didn't occur to me as being mentors in that sense, and they are famous people like Martin Luther King Jr., who are certainly worthy of respect and admiration. But mentor, defining them as your mentor, I think that's going to lead us to our next question. And really, does it, if we're going to define mentors as professionals and as famous people that we look up to and we follow the word of, and people are using also religious leaders who, like Mahatma Gandhi and things like that, who are not probably personal, and they're not alive anymore. And so does it matter? Do mentors need to be living, and do they need to be personal? Can you have a mentor who's a famous person? What do you think about that? My first reaction is, I think of a mentor as someone who is personal to me and who I can ask a question of, but I'm getting some disagreement, and that's good. That's why we have these discussions. Yeah. Let's see what you guys think. Xu Ang thinks that you can follow the advice of a mentor who has since passed. You can follow the advice of a mentor who has since passed. So they were personal to you, and they gave you lots of good advice, and they've passed away, they've died, but you still regard them as your mentor, and you still follow their advice. I think that's perfectly reasonable, actually, yeah. I suppose that that would be a mentor who is no longer living, but they are personal. They were personal to you at the time, like a family member even. Yeah, people, a lot of people are using family members as an example of mentors, and of course they are. They are people who take a real, serious, honest, reliable, trustworthy, experienced interest in you, and they're your advisors and your counselors, and they give you a moral compass. Sometimes they're also your spiritual leader, right? And they're perfect mentors. In fact, they're your first ones, probably. Mm-hmm. And they stay that way throughout your lives, hopefully. But your mentor can be someone you follow, the advice of a mentor who has since passed. Yep, I suppose that's true. Angela's making a good point. You know, this is an interesting distinction that quite a few of you are making. And it's this distinction between mentor and role model. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they're the same person, but there was kind of a distinction. Angela says that a mentor needs to be personal and needs to be someone you can ask advice and questions of. Otherwise, they are a role model. Needs to be personal and someone you can ask advice and questions of. Otherwise, they are a role model. And I suppose mentor and role model are very similar, although I do kind of think a mentor is more personal than a role model sometimes. Could be the same person. Your role model could mentor you, couldn't they? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Carson says that mentoring is a personal, ongoing relationship. Mm-hmm. I've got kind of a split. I think the majority of people are saying that a mentor should be someone you could ask questions of personally, and that a celebrity or someone you deeply respect but don't personally know are really a role model. I think that's a reasonable distinction, and I think it's one we're going to go with for this show. How's that? I mean, not necessarily, you know, we have no rules at Recipe for Peace now. It's whatever, well, we need to be ethical, but it's whatever it is that you feel in your heart is true. But I think that there's a distinction there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mentors need to be personal, and you can ask advice and questions. Otherwise, they're a role model. And mentoring is a personal, ongoing relationship. Mm-hmm. I think that's reasonable. Mm-hmm. Okay. And we're getting a lot of agreement that mentoring is a little different than being a role model. It's more personal. More of the call up and ask advice on a specific issue and respect the opinion that is given, the advice that is given. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how on earth do we select a mentor? Mm-hmm. How are we going to get one of these wonderful things? In fact, thank you for all of your participation. Quite a few people are asking how you get a mentor. because, well, most of us have them. Sometimes we don't think of them in that way. Mostly they're family members or perhaps people in our school or people in an organization we belong to or people at work. Mm-hmm. So how can we select a mentor? This is an interesting point. Quite a few people are saying that you don't select a mentor. They have to volunteer. How else, and others are saying that a mentor must volunteer. Must volunteer. Well, that would leave out the professionals that we just talked about because, of course, they're being paid. Yeah. Now, they could decline you as a client, but they have an economic advantage in not doing so, right? Mm-hmm. We're getting a split. Quite a few people say that a mentor should volunteer, but there are those of us that think, as Wendy does, that you need to actually ask to be mentored, and then the person can volunteer to accept. You have to ask them. I think that if you've got somebody you would like to have give you advice and help and be your mentor, I think acknowledgement that you would like that would not be inappropriate. You know, and if it's somebody that your go-to person to ask advice, well, they are your mentor, even if you haven't specifically thought of them in that way, given them the label. Ask them really formally to be your mentor. But they've kind of slid into the role, right? We know people like that. And perhaps we are doing it with others also. In fact, I think I am. That you give advice, people come to you and ask questions and advice, and you give them your honest answer. Well, you've been their mentor, and people who do it for you are yours, even though you haven't exactly in some way formalized the relationship and said, would you please be my mentor? Well, you've already established the relationship, and you kind of are, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, this is an interesting point that I also hadn't thought about when we started this. Yay! That quite a few people, Armando and others, are saying that you get your mentor from the volunteer pool through an organization. Mm-hmm. And that if you get someone like that, you need a good personality fit. Good point, Armando and others, that you need a good personality fit if your mentor is a stranger to you, essentially speaking. You know, in the United States, and I'm sure internationally too, since this is an international show, there are lots of lovely, well, not even so much charitable, I guess they're charitable, but lots of helping organizations. And a lot of them set up mentoring programs, especially for younger people just getting out of school, or for new business people, or for certain professions or whatever, where people can come and get someone, for lack of a better word, assigned to them to ask them questions and advice. Mm-hmm. And it's called mentoring. It is. Sometimes, for good point, that schools have that to help kids, and not such small kids, learn and to give them, like, tutoring. Mm-hmm. And that all is called mentoring. But they're not people who chose each other, really. They're people who are strangers who get to know each other through the mentoring process. Yeah. And as Armando says, if you're going to do such a thing, it needs a good personality fit. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes, if you get an assigned mentor, you can, without insulting anybody, kind of ask if someone has more expertise in a specific area, for example. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But if it's a good personality fit and they really know something and they're willing, and it's wonderful. A lot of times they're retired people. In the United States, people get, sometimes big corporations will give credit to their employees, like time off credit. I don't know about money, but time off credit, if nothing else. And also kind of good idea, resume enhancer. Yeah, people are using the word brownie points. Yeah, well, you know, it's kind of an unspoken job requirement that you do some sort of work in the community. And that's how sometimes people become mentors, because they have certain expertise. Yeah, all good. And they're nice, sincere people, but they need to really fit with your personality. And if we are the volunteer and we're doing it, we're the mentor, we can't be insulted if someone wants to switch, because it's not personal. It wasn't personal to begin with, because we weren't personal to them. And they needed something else from the mentoring experience than what our expertise can give them. Or our personalities simply clash. Or they need more time than we can give them. Good point. Mm-hmm. Matthew Paula says that mentors need to be accessible and willing to donate time. Yes, mentoring is a very, very time-consuming concept, because you have to be accessible, as Paula and others are saying. You have to be willing to answer and willing to look at something and willing to help. And that's accessible, and that's time, too. That's something that you are asking someone to give you. Mm-hmm. You know, this is an interesting point that Matthew and others are making. We talked about changing mentors because you got them kind of from an anonymous pool of people from an organization, for example. But Matthew and others are saying that you can change mentors as you progress in your skills and knowledge. Yeah, I think you remain friends, of course, and acquaintances and like that, but you can, well, for lack of a better word, and a lot of people are using it, you can indeed outgrow your mentor relationship. Yeah, you've learned all you can, and you need to move on to a different set of expertise, a different mentor who has different skills. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the people we mentor want to learn different skills, too, than we can teach them. Mm-hmm. We've taught them all we pretty much know how to teach them in this specific area. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can change mentors as you progress in skills and knowledge. Good point. Mm-hmm. You know, Carolyn and others are saying that they have had a series of mentors throughout their life. You start with your parents, really. You start with your family, and then you work into school, and then professional. Yeah, the series of mentors throughout life. And if you're very, very fortunate, you keep contact with the people who are no longer your go-to mentor, because you made friends with them. And I know a lot of people like that. They helped me, and I was really, really grateful, and it was a wonderful experience. And whatever their specific expertise is, I know it. I'm skilled in it. I have perhaps even outpaced them, truth be told. So they're no longer my mentor, but they are still my friend. Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point. They are probably role models, people who I would like to emulate, people who I respect. Mm-hmm. This is all true. Yeah. So, now that we've decided what a mentor is, and we've decided how we could acquire one or be one, you need to ask, basically speaking. Mm-hmm. And in order to be one, you have to be accessible. And you want to pick someone who's accessible and is willing to put in the time. Mm-hmm. And won't be insulted if they are one of a series and they become friends and role models, but no longer go-to mentors. Right, right. So what do we look for in a mentor? And what do people look for in us if they want us to be a mentor? Because most of us have progressed to a point where we have skills and knowledge and expertise, and we might be willing to share and have the time, and we will make excellent mentors. So what should one look for? Mm-hmm. Max says specific skills and knowledge that we need to learn. Good point. Specific skills and knowledge that we need to learn. Something I need to know. And this person is an expert, has specific skills and knowledge. I would like him or her to be willing to mentor me, to be willing to show me how. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Elizabeth and others are saying that the most important trait in a mentor is the willingness to share. Willingness to share information, to share opinions, to share expertise, to share time. Yeah, willingness to share. Mm-hmm. Zane and others are saying that also a mentor not only needs to be willing to share, but they need to be a good, successful example. Mm-hmm. They're qualified as role model. They've just taken it a step further, and they've been nice enough to give you personal advice. But they're good, successful examples of what we'd like to be, of what our goal is. Because they've done it, therefore they can tell us how to do it, and we respect what they say because we know that they've done it already, that they've reached their goal. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a very good point, too. Bettina says that the main thing she looks for in a mentor is honesty in opinions, even if they're later proven wrong. You know, you can only have an opinion given the fact you know at the time, at that time. That's all. What, you know, there's an expression, it's probably an Americanism, but it's undoubtedly the same expression everywhere, and this is, of course, a global show. And it's that hindsight is 20/20. Hindsight is 20/20. When you look, when you stand in the future, so to speak, and you look back at decisions that were made and opinions that were given, you go, wow, that was really wrong. But at the time when it was offered, the opinion, given the facts and the circumstances and what everybody knew, it was an honest, reasonable opinion. It's just that it didn't turn out true, but that's because in the future, from when the opinion was made, things changed. Or they didn't have all the facts. You see, but it's still an honest opinion, even if it was proven wrong. And being able to have someone to give you their honest opinion is very valuable. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sean says that leadership to help us navigate to the right choice is important with a mentor. Leadership to help us navigate to the right choice. Mm-hmm. To help us see all sides, maybe. Yeah. And to really kind of discuss it out, kind of think about it from everybody's perspective. What does this mean, and what do you think will happen if? Mm-hmm. And give advice based upon, well, mostly on past experience, I imagine, and on expertise. Yeah. Vince has hit a very important element of being a mentor, and that's the willingness and the ability to listen. The willingness and the ability to listen. What do I need? What am I saying? What am I asking for? You ever have it where you know that you need to get to some sort of a goal, but you're really not sure what to ask for to get there because you're not sure how to do it, right? And the choice is unclear, or you don't realize that you have choices. Yeah, that's an interesting point too. Mentors bring out choices. And they oftentimes think about something that you didn't even think about. And you go, oh my, I don't know why I didn't think about that, but I didn't. And it's because your mentor has had more experience than you are, than you have, more experience than you've had. And they are mentors, and we are mentors, because we have a lot of experience too, to be willing to share that. Mm-hmm. And they go, well, you know, you have choices here. And you go, yeah, I've got two choices, this or this. And they go, well, no, there's a third choice. And you go, oh, thank you for telling me. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a good point that Tim is making, that they not only have to have the willingness and the ability to listen, but they need to not be promoting an outside agenda. They need to really be in your corner, in your best interests. They need not to promote an outside agenda. Mm-hmm. Oh, people asking, thank you for all your participation. People asking, what does that mean? Kind of a not all your in best interests at heart. They've got some sort of an outside reason for having their opinions. And it's not just their personal opinion, but it's colored by an outside reason, usually a professional reason. They've got a quota to make. They have a boss to please. They've been told to sway you one way or another. Yeah. That's not what we had in the mind. We talked about mentors. So you have to be careful. Have to think about it. Mm-hmm. Linda is making a good point that you need enough experience to share, but also wisdom to allow personal choices. You ever hear the expression, my way or the highway? Right? You have to do it my way because I've told you how. And if you don't do it my way, then you're wrong and I'm insulted. No, because that's an opinion your way. And you need to have experience so that you can share it, but also the wisdom to allow personal choices. What a good way of putting it. Experience to share, but also the wisdom to allow personal choices. Thank you, Linda. Nice way of putting it. Mm-hmm. Ooh, Nicholas and others are bringing up a good point, and thank you for all of your participation. Nicholas and others are bringing up a good point that you have to be, in order to be a mentor or to have someone who is your mentor, you should be able to listen without judgment. Listen without judgment. Uh-huh. And then make suggestions, right? But not be judgmental so that you don't not want to go to them. Because every time you go there, they think you're an idiot and it shows, you know? Well, gee, that's not a very good mentor because it's not your fault you didn't think about the choices, probably. You needed someone to point them out to you. Mm-hmm. Listening without judgment. You know, Anne and others are adding another listening, that not only listen without judgment, but you need to listen with compassion. Listen with compassion. And I would say empathy, which is rather like compassion, but it's being able to put yourself in someone else's shoes and see why they did whatever it was and tell them what they should do now. Can it give them advice. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Listen with compassion. Mm-hmm. Raymond and others are saying that a mentor should not overwhelm the person with advice and then be insulted when not all of it is followed. We got to remember this not only for the people we deal with as our mentors, but we need to especially remember it for ourselves when we are mentors, right? You have to not, mentors should not overwhelm with advice and then be insulted when not all of it is followed. It's to help the person. It's not just to force them to do it like you would do it. It's entitled to choices, personal choices, right? Right. Mm-hmm. You know, Felice and others are saying, this is a very good point, that in order to be a mentor or to have someone who's a mentor, they must be trusted to keep a confidence because you tell them things, right? Not illegal things, not horrible things, but this is a very good point. And Armando and others are making it, that you show your mentor weakness, right? Because you have to ask a question that you don't know the answer to, and you don't want everybody in the room to know that you don't know, right? But you need to go to your trusted advisor and hash it out and see what can be done. Mm-hmm. So they need to be trusted to keep a confidence, keep a secret, right? And not just tell that you were unsure or you were indecisive or that you had several choices and you chose this one and why. Yeah, they need to be able to keep a confidence. Mm-hmm. Bert says that a mentor must also have a positive attitude. I think that's true. You have to have enthusiasm. You have to have a positive attitude. First of all, it makes you better to work with, and it makes the mentor better to work with. But a positive attitude is necessary so we can have a successful outcome, right? Yeah, it's important. It's important to be not be negative and to go forward and say, yes, we're going to be able to do this. Mm-hmm. You know, Kaylin and others are saying that in order to be a successful mentor or to choose a successful mentor, that the person needs to have good people skills, to model proper technique and seeing people as individuals. You need to have some people skills. You need to be able to deal with people and to, when something is described to you for your advice, to be able to look at it in a manner that will be, well, be compromised, that will be good for all sides and good for your person that you're giving the advice to. Good for us or for the people that are getting the advice. But it needs to be, there's people skills in that, right? Yeah. And that's a good segue into the idea that in order to have people skills, you need to practice. And in order to practice, you need to be able to handle a group, handle participants. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes we are the leader, and we need to know if somebody is acting in a manner that is less than gracious, how to handle it. And one of the ways is to, of course, when you see that things are heating up, to separate everyone and not let it go any further by having a timeout. Mm-hmm. And when we have a timeout, we like to keep people in the room and keep them from kind of scattering and also keep them from going off and asking somebody who's worse than they are and then their opinions and their intransigence gets written in stone. So, what are we going to do? Yes, it's the recipe time. Hooray! We're going to have food, right? Yeah. And, you know, I say this all the time, but it's really true that the food, the potluck, the bringing of food, the breaking of bread as the group during the participation, so that we have a moment to catch our breath and to maybe even ask a question of our mentor, right? We could make a phone call, they could be in the room. Yeah, to actually think things through in a civil manner and to have a convivial atmosphere, right? It's really important to have something to keep people there, and that's the food part. The food is a tool. It's not because we're hungry. I mean, we might be hungry, but it's not because we're serving dinner. The food is a tool to keep the atmosphere convivial, to be good mentors by thinking things through and thinking through our opinions, right? And also so that we get to know each other somewhat, so that we can have a personal relationship. And even if we're not going to be friends, I mean, it's not required that you like each other, really, just that you be able to deal with each other. And networking is a really overused word, and I hate to use it, but it is kind of networking, right? It gets you out of the formal event, the negotiation, the seminar, the workshop, whatever it is we're doing, and into a more informal atmosphere to meet your fellow human, right? Right. Now, if we're going to have food, and now we've decided that we are, it's also very important, and I say this every show because it is so important. By the way, last five shows archived on our website, recipeforpeacenow.com. blogtalkradio.com. All of the shows are archived on the radio station, blogtalkradio.com/recipe for peace now. Yeah. And so I say this every time, but it's terribly important. If you're going to have food, you've got to take a survey. You've got to ask everybody if they have a food allergy, a food prohibition, or religious prohibition to some sort of food, right? Right. You don't want people to have a bad time. And then you circulate this information. Also, when anybody brings food, it needs to be labeled. Not what it is, meatloaf. No, what is in it, so that you can decide if you can eat it, because you can look at the list of ingredients. Mm-hmm. Also, just because I hate having a bad party, and a bad party is one where the food runs out, I think that the leader, who is usually us, should arrange to have some extra food. And I like to have a safe dish, for sure. And what is a safe dish? Well, it doesn't have too many ingredients. We've taken the survey, so our participants are probably not allergic or prohibited from them. And they are ingredients that people in my group, and I'm in the States, so my group might be different than yours. In fact, it probably is. People in my group would have eaten the ingredients before. They would be familiar with them and know if they can, right? Right. Also, I kind of like ingredients in the safe dish that are fairly obvious. I like to hide things. In fact, one of my real things that I always say is never put fish sauce in anything, especially meat things. It's not a good idea. Yeah, people might be allergic to it. Mm-hmm. So, here is our safe recipe this time. Why is it safe? Because it has a bunch of stuff that we're going to be familiar with. This one is actually basically vegetarian, although not vegan because of the noodles. But it is a vegetarian. You can put some chicken in it. It would still be a safe recipe because chicken most people can eat. And that would give it a little extra protein and a little extra, well, I don't know if this is kind of a main dish or not, but it would give it some extra piece in there. Mm-hmm. So add chicken if you'd like. Cooked chicken, of course. Yes, 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 yes. Mm-hmm. So here we go. It's in noodles with pineapple and vegetables. So we're going to use about a pound of nice thin noodles. Mm-hmm. Actually, this breaks one of my rules because I always say not to use thin noodles because they're more messy. You can use pasta that is like bow tie pasta, not the kind that's real thick, like those tube pastas. I like kind of a thinner one for this, like a bow tie, just because it's got a lot of vegetables and it kind of needs to meld together. Yeah. So, but if you use thin noodles, they'll cook better. So you have to make up your mind. We're going to cook and we're going to drain them. So they're all boiled. You put them in the hot water. You drain al dente, right? Not too mushy. And you drain them and you set them aside. Mm-hmm. So they're all cooked. And now we're going to have a quarter of a cup of vegetable oil. We're going to have a nice green pepper that we're going to devein and deseed and slice. Red pepper, same thing, devein, deseed, slice. 3 stalks of celery, going to slice them up. Yep. A carrot, well, let's have 3 carrots also. 3 carrots, we're going to slice those. We're going to, of course, peel them and slice them. Mm-hmm. Kind of medium, not real thin. Let's get some mushrooms that we're going to slice up. In the United States, you can buy sliced mushrooms. I have no idea what kind they are, but they're nice and big and good-looking and white. A mushroom that's big enough to slice. Let's have about a pound of those. I like lots of stuff in it. You can probably get away with a little less than I put in. Let's have 3 teaspoons of cornstarch because we're going to make the sauce a little bit thick. 2 tablespoons of malt vinegar. 2 teaspoons, which is a tablespoon, I guess, of tomato paste, the thick stuff. Uh-huh. Let's see. Let's have a big can of pineapple pieces. Not in the syrupy juice, in the natural juice. if you get the syrupy juice, it's going to get kind of strange because we're going to use the juice. Like a 16-ounce can. Mm-hmm. In the United States, pineapple just comes in cans. If you want to use fresh pineapple, yours will be better than mine. So get yourself, about a pound or so of fresh pineapple cut into little pieces and get some pineapple juice because fresh pineapple doesn't have much juice. The side, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we've got our noodles are already cooked, right? We're going to heat the vegetable oil and big frying pan. If you want to do this in the room and you've got the facilities, this is one of those that's kind of a stir fry, and it's lovely to do. I always say together, and then I get emails and people say, well, you haven't really cooked together. You've done a display. And I suppose that's true. But the leader can cook this up, whoever's making it, can have everything prepped in little containers and put them in as you go. And it smells lovely, and it's nice to make, and it's nice to watch somebody do it. Yeah, it's a fun group experience. So we're going to heat the oil. If you've got a wok, that looks nicer, of course, but quite frankly, I just use a big frying pan. And we're going to add both kinds of peppers, the green and the red, and the celery and the carrots and the mushrooms, and we're going to stir fry it. What, about 5 minutes? It doesn't take very long because we cut them kind of thin. Mm-hmm. Now we're going to add the noodles because they're already cooked, but this will give them some oil and some taste and like that. So we're going to add our cooked noodles, our cooked pasta, to the stir-fry. And we can reduce the heat a little bit and stir-fry for a couple of minutes just to get everything blended together. Mm-hmm. And we're going to take our cornstarch and the vinegar, and we're going to whisk it until it's nice and smooth. And we're going to stir in the tomato paste and the pineapple pieces, get it all stirred up. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, we probably should have done that first, huh? Made the little sauce, yeah. And then we've got everything in the frying pan or in the wok. We've already stir-fried it. It's already nice and hot and yummy, and it's making a nice sizzly noise, and it's delicious. We're going to pour this pineapple mixture we just made into the wok, and we're going to stir-fry it all around until the thing really gets hot and starts to boil and thickens. So we've got everything combined, and we're stir-frying it. We're whipping it around and like that. And when everything is incorporated and the sauce is really hot and it boils and the whole thing's kind of thickened, you're done. It takes not long because it's stir-fry, right? And everything is really cooked. And if you put in chicken, of course, you put in cooked chicken, little chunks of cooked chicken, not try to cook it in the wok. You have to cook it first, yeah. Because you can't make it cook through enough like that. And so there we have it. That's our safe recipe. Vegetarian, which is easy for safe. And it is items that people are familiar with. And you can, yes, you can add spice, more spice to it if you would like. These are just basic recipes which give you the idea of what it is that you'd like to do. And yeah, I think that putting in chicken is a really good idea. If people are asking about all kinds of different kinds of protein, if you put in ham or pork or something, you've got to be careful. It may no longer be a safe recipe because a lot of people don't eat pork product, either for religious or just personal dietary reasons. Yeah. So I always think that makes things an adventure recipe. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So delicious, smells really nice in the room, can make it all together, and it is our safe recipe. Now let's go on to our adventure recipe. What makes this an adventure recipe? Well, it's got some flavoring that my people would not necessarily be familiar with. Sauerkraut is not a real common thing, and this is a veal goulash. A listener sent this recipe in. Thank you very much, Brian. And it is just yummy. We tried it, and it's very veal stew with kind of a little kick to it. And it's really very good. It's It's really delicious, and it's kind of getting towards fall in this area, although at the moment it's hot. But it's a nice hearty dish, and you know, you serve it with a spoon and with some accompaniments on the side, like some pasta or some rice. And so that people can take that and put it underneath. Yeah, people are saying mashed potatoes, something like that. Mashed potatoes would be lovely. I would have thought egg noodles, but mashed potatoes is lovely too. Something to the side so that you can choose it. Yeah. So let's start. So this is a veal goulash. Lovely. We're going to have a tablespoon of oil and 3 pounds of like a shoulder roast of the veal. So it doesn't have to be a real expensive cut, but if it's got a bone in it, get 3 pounds of meat. You know what I mean? Take the bone out and get enough meat so that you've got 3 pounds of meat. And we're going to give it a little bit of a trim because it's a little bit more of a fatty meat. And we're going to cut it into nice chunks, well, about 1.5-inch chunks. Let's have a really large onion that we're going to coarsely chop. 3 garlic cloves, crushed. People say I use a lot of garlic. I do. If you don't like that much, don't do it. This is actually goulash, so we're going to use something that's unusual to my neck of the woods. 3 tablespoons of paprika. Makes it a nice red color, but it is a rather unusual spice here. This is an international show. It may be something that you use constantly. Let's have a nice jar, 16-ounce jar of sauerkraut. It comes in a jar around here. I don't know how it comes by you, but it is pre-made, and if you've got a choice, I like kind of a mild because, you know, I don't like to make anything too pungent. You need to drain the sauerkraut. You need to seriously drain the sauerkraut. You need to kind of put it on a paper towel type drain the sauerkraut because the juice or whatever they call the watery juice that sauerkraut comes in, you don't want that in your goulash. You just want the sauerkraut. And let's have a nice 16-ounce can of diced tomatoes, just pieces of tomatoes, doesn't have to be whole tomatoes, with the juice. We're going to use the juice, too. You want to use fresh. You're going to be a better person than I am. It'll be more delicious. Remember to make up for the liquid. And let's have a whole can, a 16-ounce can of beef broth, because we're going to make this a stew after all, and it's going to be cooked for quite a while. And let's put some water in a cup, about a cup of water, and we'll see how it goes as we're doing it. Right. So we're going to get ourselves a nice baking pot, like a Dutch oven, a 6-quart Dutch oven, and we're going to put the oil in it, and we're going to heat it up. And we're going to cook the veal pieces on all sides until they're browned on all sides. Do not skip this step, even though it seems like, so what, we're going to cook the veal anyway, because it seals in the juices, and if you don't brown the meat on all sides in the oil before you cook it, really, it will be tough. It will not be nice. Okay. So you probably cook it in batches when you put it aside. Yeah. And while we're doing that, we're going to preheat our oven to 350 because we're going to bake this. It's not just stew like in the boiling on the stove. It's a baked stew. It's a goulash, Hungarian goulash. It's a veal goulash. Yes, people are already asking about beef. Why not? In all truth and honesty, the recipe came to us with veal, and veal is, of course, lovely. You could make it with, and that may be traditional too, you could make it with beef. In fact, we've actually made it with beef. It's yummy. And you could also make it with lamb. Why not? Yeah. So, preheat the oven. Now we've got our meat all browned on all sides, whatever kind we're using. We've still got oil and nibbly bits of meat in the pot, in the Dutch oven. Add the onion, brown it up. Make it nice and translucent. Stir in the garlic and the paprika. And cook another minute so that it's all incorporated and it all smells lovely. Now we're going to return our meat to the pot. We're going to call it veal, but we're going to turn our meat to the pot. Stir it all around, right? Now we're going to stir in the sauerkraut. The whole can of tomatoes with the juice, too. the broth, and we'll just put in half a cup of water, right? We don't want it to be too watery, but we don't want to stick and not make it either. And we're going to heat it up, and we're going to put it on the stove, and we're going to boil it, what about, until it really gets boiling, until it really gets going, and we're going to scrape the bits, round bits off the bottom of the Dutch oven, right? Now it's all incorporated. It's all hot. It's all boiled. We've reduced some of the liquid. We look at it. We go, it's going to be in the oven for an hour and a half. It might need more liquid. That's when we put in a little bit more water, like a quarter of a cup at a time. You got to look at it and see. It needs to be kind of moist, but not watery, which is why I say don't put all the water in at once. So we've got it off the stove. We're going to cover our Dutch oven. We're going to place it in the oven. And we're going to bake it an hour and a half until your veal, your meat, whatever kind of lamb, whatever you've used, is nice and soft. Yeah, until it's nice and tender and it is, you know, all falling apart and everything, but still, it still makes cubes. But with the sauerkraut and the beef, oh, it's so delicious. Yes, you wouldn't think it would be, but it has a lovely texture and kind of a different taste to it, which is why it's our adventure recipe. Because we've got all kinds of different things. We've got paprika. It's an unusual spice in this area. And sauerkraut. And, you know, people are saying to put seeds in it, that a traditional Hungarian goulash has caraway seeds, if you'd like, but you have to put those on the list, right? A lot of people are allergic to different kinds of seeds. I don't know if caraway is a big offender or not, but you don't want to take the chance. And that would really be an unusual thing in this area, right? Right. And something that you can't see once it's cooked. So that's kind of tricky. Yeah. So it's our adventure recipe. Delicious. You serve it, of course, with some sort of a starch to put underneath it. Yeah. Delicious. So that is our two recipes, and we are almost out of time. Thank you very much for being here. Thank you for all of your participation. If you would like to contact us, we're at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com. The website is recipeforpeacenow.com. Last five shows archived on our website, recipeforpeacenow.com. All of the shows, including the last five, archived on the radio station at blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. Thank you for all of your participation. Thank you for being here. I always learn something on these shows. I always say they're organic, and they are, because we go wherever the questions take us. They're not actually pre-scripted in any way. And we took several turns that I didn't even expect. So that was exciting. I hope you learned something, too. Thank you for coming. Thank you for listening. And please do come again. Thanks. Bye-bye.